Tuesday overwhelmingly picked Milwaukee County Judge Rebecca Dallet to serve on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. She'll serve for the next decade, be the sixth female justice on a court with the highest percentage of female justices in the nation. It's where we begin Week in Review. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. At the table this week, Kevin Hermaning. He chairs the Republican Party of Marathon County. He's a financial planner from Wausau. Kevin, welcome back. Oops. Oh, he's not there quite yet. We're having a tiny... Oh, there he is. Or we're working on it. There he is. There he is. Hey there. Welcome back.
That. Sorry.
That's okay. John Nichols is here. He's associate editor of the Capital Times, national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine. John, welcome back to you.
It's great to be with you and Kevin.
Well,
hello, John.
Hey, Kevin.
Well, some media outlets used clobbered, another used trounced in the Supreme Court election. Wisconsin voters easily selected Milwaukee County Judge Rebecca Dallet over Sauk County Judge Michael Skrenak by a margin of 56% to 44%, or nearly 115,000 votes statewide. Kevin, what does this election mean? What are you looking in? Are you looking at it in a certain way?
Well, it is true that Judge Dallet ran a race that motivated her supporters, and we extend our congratulations to her. I was sorry to see the result of the election. But, you know, the blue wave that's out there is a very real thing. I was at an event with former chancellor of the UW system and Secretary of Health and Human Services, Donna Shalala, joined by former governor and former secretary of DHS, Tommy Thompson, on Wednesday night in Wausau. And they both spoke about the blue wave. And so what the Republicans need to do is to put something in the place that can stop the blue wave, and that's perhaps a red wall. We're going to see.
Are you putting a hashtag in front of that?
Not quite yet, but we're working on it. We are working on it. And, you know, Judge Skrenak ran a good race. I believe he did. Some people think he ran a poor race. He was out and about. He was in Marathon. Excuse me. He was in Marathon County four times in just the last 4 weeks. And Marathon County delivered half the difference in the Trump election in the state of Wisconsin. I think that President Trump won by 26,000 votes in Marathon County, which is where Wausau is. Delivered 13,000 of that differential. So he certainly visited the places he needed to, but it just was not enough. There were so many motivated voters on the other side, and we all know that the Democrats and Judge Dallet and her team really they did something that's rarely been accomplished in a spring election. They matched in intensity for absentee ballots in Dane County what normally occurs in a presidential year. So that this was being discussed about 7 to 10 days before the actual election, that things were not looking very good for Mr. Skrenak.
So context there from Kevin. John, what did we learn about voters here?
Well, I appreciate Kevin's graciousness about Michael Skrenak, the candidate that conservatives backed for the high court. And I think he's right. I think Skrenak worked hard. He wasn't a particularly good candidate, but usually candidates for Supreme Court aren't particularly good as candidates. They're running to be judges. And in this case, though, one thing that shouldn't be underestimated is that Rebecca Dallet was a remarkable candidate. And I think Republicans and conservatives, liberals, Democrats would all agree she was just very, very good at it. She was good at running. She ran. She started early, campaigned hard. Whether that's what you want in judicial races, that's, you can debate that. But clearly she was a very strong contender. That's number one. Number two, as Kevin says, there's an intense motivation, no matter who was the more liberal, more progressive candidate in this race, to get out and support that candidate. You saw it in Dane County, as Kevin points out. But Kevin, if I'm right, didn't Dallet win Marathon County too?
She did, yes. So, in fact, most of the 7th District, which is where Congressman Sean Duffy represents, which was a strong red area for President Trump in 2016, most of the 7th District actually was blue on Tuesday.
And so that's my point I want to make. This is the critical thing. If you look at the map from Tuesday, what you see is that in the Supreme Court race and also in the treasurer's vote, you look at the counties and how they voted, you see a recreation of the traditional progressive map, right? A good map for a progressive night. And that is that Dallet took about 36 counties, roughly half of them. She had strong votes out of Madison, Milwaukee, yes, but she also won a lot of rural and small manufacturing city counties. Democrats, and in these nonpartisan races, and remember this is a nonpartisan race, they have to win those places. They can't neglect them. And this is the critical thing I will tell you. Everybody will talk about outside money on both sides.
And we're going to follow the money in a moment.
All that all comes up. Here's the bottom line. Democrats in Wisconsin, progressives in Wisconsin, liberals, whatever you want to call them, in these nonpartisan races and in partisan races, have been lousy at going to rural and small city Wisconsin. Rebecca Dallet started doing it in July of last year.
Well, let's look at the backing here. High-profile Democrats as well as progressive groups behind Dallet, Republican Party, conservative groups lining up behind Skrenek. There was a question from both sides of whether the other candidate could be fair and impartial. And here's how Dallet responded to this criticism on election night.
What we've worried about from our court has been that the court was not fair and independent, that the court had lost confidence of the voters. And my goal was to bring that confidence back, which I think Wisconsinites showed today that we could do.
Well, Kevin, what do you make of that? This is supposed to be a nonpartisan race here. It got extremely partisan. And Dallet said she can bring that back.
Well, I think anybody who has been observing political elections for the state Supreme Court for at least the last 30 years would have to be fooling themselves or trying to fool others by suggesting that it's become anything other than partisan. Every candidate for the court during my 34 years of following Wisconsin politics and being involved in it, rolling up my sleeves and being a candidate and being county party chair and district chair and sending, you know, small contributions to candidates over the years, knows that the candidates on the state Supreme Court have all been, for the last 30 years, backed by either conservative coalitions or liberal or progressive coalitions, Republicans or Democrats. It's the reason there have been so many calls by folks who purport to be independent, and I would suggest most aren't, that it shouldn't be something that should be elected by the voters, or perhaps the term shouldn't be so lengthy, that money shouldn't be having the influence that it does. Those are all legitimate things to debate and argue and discuss, but the truth of the matter is that elections, we saw especially this year at the county and the city levels and township and school board levels, are now turning into and have been for the state Supreme Court partisan campaigns. Mm. And John, I think you've been observing this for as long as me, and I don't think that's in dispute.
I'm sorry. It's not in dispute, Kevin. And also, I think your races for Congress against Dave Obie were less partisan than the races for judgeships are now.
Well, riddle me this, John. Do you think this is a preview of what we can expect in the run-up to the special elections in Wisconsin's 1st Senate and 42nd Assembly districts about this partisan and also the outside money?
Mm-hmm. First off, the special elections are going to be intense, and they're going to be, you know, and that's what they should be, right? The governor is shameful for not calling them when he was supposed to. He was called out by one judge, second judge, third judge. It was a deeply embarrassing act by the governor. Now they've been called, and they will be very, very high profile on both sides, and that's good. Special elections should be that. By the same token, I think that what Kevin's getting to here is a deeper and a more complex issue. Whether they're partisan or not, it's the massive amount of outside money on all sides coming in that warps elections away from being real local contests where people get to choose their own representative. And we should be very concerned about this. This is the effect of this on representative democracy and on the choosing of a judiciary. Which I favor elected judiciary, I always have. I think people should be able to hold their judges to account. But by the same token is, I don't really want people from New York or from California or, you know, whatever, paying for those elections. I want those elections to be run locally. And I just point for a second to the treasurer's race. And I know we may talk about it in a moment.
Yep.
But the treasurer's contest was fascinating because it's a race that didn't have much outside money in it. It was a very grassroots.
No polling.
Grassroots campaign, mm-hmm. and the people were given a choice. Every politician in Madison said, oh, that's going to win, that'll win easy. The people voted roughly 62% against it. And so I will promise you, this outside money warps the process on both sides and in lots of ugly ways, and we ought to be thinking about what to do about it.
Wherein we can review. It is the 6th of April. Kevin Hermaning is the chairman of the Republican Party, Marathon County, financial planner from Wausau. John Nichols is associate editor of the Cap Times, national affairs correspondent of The Nation magazine. You can join in. What developments rose to the level that you are watching this week? 800-642-1234. Do you think that the results of the spring election in Wisconsin are a sign of a blue wave? Or is this a lot of fuss over nothing? Are you glad Wisconsinites voted to keep the treasurer? Why or why not? Do you want duties to be returned to the state treasurer's office or leave it as is? 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Before we get into the state treasurer situation here, I want to vet a little bit more the tweets that came from Governor Walker this week, the blue wave. Are we making more out of this, Kevin, than you think we should? Or do you really feel that Governor Walker is concerned?
No, I do think that Governor Walker is concerned. I have heard him in person at a number of Republican events for the last 2 months in Wausau. No fundraisers, just party events, caucuses, and what we call the our Lincoln Day dinners across the state, across the country for Republicans. It's our annual gatherings, and usually either candidates for governor or, in this case, the Republican sitting governor always attends, most of them, as he is able. Everybody's concerned about that during what we on the Republican side consider to be, by most measures, good economic times, 17-year low unemployment of 4.1%, more people than ever having jobs in the state of Wisconsin in the history since 1848, a record number of actual dollars into public education, and a lot of things that are pretty good trend-wise for our state and our nation, that conservatives are complacent. Conservatives were angry. They were upset. They were disgusted with President Obama and Obamacare and illegal immigration. And so they, after vetting 16 candidates for the presidency, chose President Trump, the tough guy, to come in and rein that all in. And certainly the president is not responsible for all of the economic good news that's out there, but there's been a positive positive view from a consumer confidence perspective over the last several months. And when people are what I would refer to as fat and happy, satisfied with their personal life as well as the general direction, they tend to become complacent. Mm. And people who are on the progressive side, who feel that for many reasons they believe not enough money is going into their pet projects or too much is going into the military, or they don't like what President Trump has said or done or tweeted, they're angry and upset just like conservatives were in 2016. And so now the goal is to try to match that intensity that the Democrats have by November. And it is absolutely true. This is my fourth stint in 31 years as chairman of the Marathon County Party. The governor, the state representatives, I was with six state reps last night in Mosinee at a fundraiser for Representative John Spiros, who's seeking reelection. And I can tell you that we are all worried about the complacency of the average voter. We're not angry at them. We understand. Our job is to let them know that we do not, from our perspective, want to undo the gains of the last 8 years by defeating Scott Walker, turning over the legislature to the Democrats, and failing at a pretty good opportunity to turn out Tammy Baldwin.
Let's get insights now from Chuck, joining us from Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Chuck. Go ahead.
How are you guys doing?
Doing well. Go ahead.
First of all, I wanted to thank Mr. Hermaning for his service. I'm from his hometown of Oak Creek, so we remember very well that period in our nation's history. So thank you, sir. So I'm not sure if we're going to see a blue wave regardless of any complacency on the GOP side. Yeah, recent races have kind of shown us that the Democrats might not have the deepest bench for candidates. I think the Democratic Party has been somewhat demoralized, and I'm not sure they'd run for governor. I'm not sure they'd run for major offices. They might not have the deepest bench.
Okay, so Chuck, not so sure there of seeing a blue wave. Let's go to Joe now in Weston. Joe, go ahead. You're on.
Yeah, good morning. I'm calling in regard to, what happened in Pennsylvania, the other states where they flipped seats by 20 points, that Trump carried by 20 points, and it was a major flip. Will this be a referendum on Trump? And when the Republicans lost control in the midterms several years ago, they did an autopsy of their party, making it a bigger tent, blah, blah, blah. But they never implemented any of it. And if there is a blue wave, what will they say? Like, are they going to scratch your head and say, geez, what happened? Or is it just going to be so blatantly obvious of a referendum, who's running their party, Trump in Washington? I mean, he said Mexico is going to pay for the wall. That's half of what got him elected.
Joe, thanks for those insights. Let's get John now back into the conversation here after hearing those two.
Yeah, I think, look, we're in a period of wave elections. We've had wave elections pretty much since 2006 in this country. It's an unprecedented phenomenon. And it is a result not of all the things. The politicians always make a huge mistake. And they think, oh, unemployment doesn't look so bad right now, or this doesn't look so bad. I think they use all the old models. What they're not recognizing is we're 30 years roughly into a digital revolution. We're 25 years into a globalization revolution. We're 10 years into an automation revolution. These things are changing everything about our lives. You look back and you try and think how your life was 10, 20, 30 years ago. It's radically different. People have been shaken by that, and they have failed to see leadership on one side or the other that explains this new world that they're living in. And so they keep jumping logically toward alternatives. And there's little question there'll be a blue wave this year. I don't know what it will be. The Democrats certainly don't have, in every case, their first tier candidates. But you'd never heard of Rebecca Dallet a year ago. And so the reality is I think people make a mistake if they think about candidates. What they have to think about is the mood of the moment. I think Trump is a factor. But one final thing I'll throw in the mix here that I do think is really important about this. There is an anger at politicians trying to game the system and game the process. I think Governor Walker did more damage to his own brand and to his own party through the first few months of this year by refusing to call those special elections, by going out with this treasurer's referendum, which wasn't just him. There were a lot of other people for it. I mean, this all looked very much like people who had limited interest in what citizens said and a lot of interest in what they wanted to get done. And I believe strongly that we're in a moment where politicians, career politicians that do that, are in tremendous, tremendously vulnerable positions. And I think the governor is right to fear a blue wave.
While voters were at the polls casting their ballots in the spring election Tuesday, Governor Walker put pen to paper, signing 64 bills into law. We're moving through the developments on Week in Review. Kevin Hermaning is here, chairman of the Republican Party of Marathon County. John Nichols as well, associate editor of the Cap Times. And you at the table, 800-642-1234. Do you think that the results of the spring election in Wisconsin are a sign of a blue wave? Or do you think Governor Walker's tweets are being blown out of proportion? Are you glad Wisconsinites voted to keep the treasurer? Why or why not? Call in, email, ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. On On a Friday, it means we're making time for a week in review, taking the week's developments one bite at a time. Like most weeks, there's a lot on our plate. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. At the table this week, it's Kevin Hermaning, chairman of the Republican Party of Marathon County, financial planner from Wausau. John Nichols here as well, associate editor of the Cap Times, national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine. And you as well, 800-642-1234. What do you think of the president's decision to deploy with the Wisconsin National Guard to the border with Mexico? What do you make of the latest volley in the fight over tariffs between the U.S. and China? How do you see your situation impacted? Call in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Well, before we get into national stories, let's stop for a moment and reflect on the state treasurer position. The current treasurer, Matt Adamczyk, he had argued the office no longer had any real duties. He was lobbying for getting rid of it. So, Kevin, I mean, we're kind of scratching our heads on this one. Should lawmakers start the process over in trying to remove the office from the Constitution? Are we back to square one?
Well, I think, you know, the push to keep it was led by former treasurer Jack Voight. And he was a Republican, there was a lot of there was a lot of confusion among Republicans about how they should vote. I know of a lot of households that were split. Husbands voted one way, wives the other. This is not a motivating issue. Most people in the Republican Party, and you could tell by the actual numbers, when you look at the disparity on the turnout here compared to the Dallet race, clearly a lot of people who supported Judge Skronek supported keeping the state treasurer as an elected position. I think there is a merit to giving additional responsibilities to the lieutenant governor. I believe there is merit there. But most people I know believe that it makes more sense to have more accountability in elective offices, and that's what this really does, by retaining the treasurer as an elected post. These battles, though, go back even to conversations about the Secretary of State. I mean, the Secretary of State legislatively over the last roughly 15 years has been stripped of most of his powers, and his office is in the basement and doesn't have a lot of responsibility anymore, but still commands a salary. And you know, if the legislature really wanted to get rid of his post, they need to push these things back through the constitutional process again.
Yeah, we've been hearing the weaving in of the basement office metaphor. John, is it time to return duties to the office of the
treasurer? Absolutely,
100%.
Yes. My great-great-great-great, I'm going to be bad on the count, grandfather was the territorial treasurer of Wisconsin, briefly, when he went back to running his bar. You know, the fact of the matter is that this office has existed since statehood. It has been under assault in recent decades, the office of state treasurer and secretary of state, by politicians who want to concentrate power. And that's wrong. That's unhealthy. It is stunning to me.
On both sides.
On both sides, absolutely. It's stunning to me that Scott Walker, somebody who says he's a, you know, conservative, believes in, you know, all sorts of traditional conservative values, would be out there saying, yeah, I want to eliminate these elected posts. It's a horrible, horrible message. So, yes, the treasurer's office's powers should be restored. It should be restored to such an extent that somebody as competent on financial issues as Kevin Hermaning could run for it proudly and maybe get elected to it, or some Democrat on the other side, that it would be an office people would seek for that reason. Secondly, Kevin brings up the lieutenant governor's office. These are not either or. The lieutenant governor's powers should be restored as well. The lieutenant governor should not run in conjunction with the governor. We shouldn't have some sort of, you know, attached office statewide. It should be an independent office, and the lieutenant governor, whether they're the governor's party or not, should be the leader of the presiding officer in the state Senate, as was traditional. We have moved away from classic models of dispersed power in a real democracy. These should be elected posts, and anybody of either party that suggests that we ought to alter our Constitution to get rid of statewide elected posts that do checks and balances, or wants to weaken them and put them in the basement, those people don't respect the basic concepts of a healthy and functional democracy. I get mad at them.
Well,
I really do.
Kevin, any final thoughts here before we move on to national?
I was just going to add that the era of lieutenant governors running in conjunction with the governor goes back to at least the days of Pat Lucey before he became the ambassador to Mexico.
Right. So, it's 67 they changed it. Yeah.
57. Okay. Yep,
67.
Right
67.
That, 67. That's right in that ballpark then. Yep.
Yeah.
Well, moving on here, President Trump tweeted Sunday that the border wall agents aren't being allowed to do their job properly, saying that Republicans must use the nuclear option to pass tough laws. He ended that tweet with four words, no more DACA deal. Then on Tuesday, he suggested he'd like to deploy troops to secure the area. Here he is.
We're going to be doing things militarily. Until we can have a wall and proper security, we're going to be guarding our border with the military.
So a day later, he signed a proclamation for deployment of the National Guard to the southern border. Kevin, before we get your thoughts here, let's bring in Doug from central Minnesota on this. Doug, go ahead.
Hi, guys. How are you doing today?
Morning.
I think it's a good idea in the respect that if you look on your phone and take time to research the most dangerous cities in the world, 14 of them, the first top 14 are Central America. Where are the people coming from? Where is MS-13 coming from? Where are the drugs coming from? People overlook that for votes. They figure if they bring enough people in and do enough free things for them, that they'll vote for them, overlooking what it's actually doing to the country. And we're not any safer now than what we were 10 years ago. Fact, it's worse. And putting people on the border, that's what the military is for, or at least the reserves are for. That's what their intent was.
Doug, thanks for that. Let's bring in Kevin now with a response.
Yeah, you know, President Trump has been picking this fight for 3 years, two and a half, 3 years, and I think it's one that ultimately he's going to end up winning. Democrats do want a DACA deal. They just want it solely on their terms. And compromise and bipartisanship, and partisans on both sides cringe at the idea that a deal should be struck where both sides have to meet somewhere near the middle. And, you know, usually, I mean, I remember the days when President Ronald Reagan would meet one-on-one and in small groups with Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill. And the president of the United States, being the top dog, if you will, in a co-equal branch of government with the U.S. House and Senate, the Congress, if you will, got just a little bit more of what he wanted than what Tip O'Neill wanted, but they both got something. And that's the way Governor Thompson has governed. And in the early days of the Governor Walker administration, it used to be that way as well. And now the Democrats, you know, having left the state and the Senate to go to Illinois during Act 10 debate, haven't really, you know, the thing that Republicans need to remember is that Democrats have a few good ideas as well. And Democrats need to understand that, you know, there are a lot of good things that Republicans believe in and have helped and put into place in law. And I think that President Trump is going to end up winning this battle. Right now, he's going to have to face a brand new battle against the governor of Oregon, who
Kate
came
Brown.
Out yesterday and said that he was not even going to comply with the order to deploy National Guard troops if Oregon is asked to participate. So that's going to be an interesting. I'll be honest and tell you that the more Democrats act, my word, maybe no one else's, in an obstinate manner like that, the more it causes Trumpsters, strong true believers in President Trump, to dig in their heels and say, this is why I voted for Donald Trump. This is why if the election were held today, I would vote for him again, and I hope most of my neighbors would as well.
Well, John,
that is what Democrats hope won't be the case in November.
Well, John, is Governor Kate Brown from Oregon, is she in the right here to say no to the president if he asks her to deploy the state's guard troops to the Mexican border?
Well, I took a couple of law courses, but I'm not sure that I can interpret that as perfectly as some other folks might. But what I'll tell you is this. Historically, the genius of the National Guard is that the governors have had a role in its deployment and mm-hmm. have had some authority to say, you know, this is where I think people should be deployed, this is not. You may get into a real legal conflict there. Kate Brown is one of the most innovative governors in the country, very, very, way far ahead of the curve on an awful lot of issues. So I'm not surprised that she was the first one to come out on this. I suspect other governors may as well. And, you know, here's the bottom line. I liked how Kevin spoke about this, because the fact of the matter is the crisis here is not, you know, it's not at the border. The crisis is in Washington, D.C. It is an absolute scorching failure by political players to get comprehensive immigration reform. And, you know, the interesting thing is that Kevin brought up Ronald Reagan, and Reagan and Tip O'Neill did chit-chat with one another. But the thing is, it's important to understand, Reagan and Republicans were critical players in comprehensive immigration reform back in the 80s. And it was really healthy for this country. Immigration is healthy for this country. And we need to understand that. This is not a Republican-Democrat issue, liberal-conservative issue. My ancestors came to this country sneaking across borders. There's no question of that. I had an ancestor who fought in the Revolutionary War. He snuck down from Canada to fight with the Green Mountain Boys. The British didn't want him there. But the fact of the matter is that in this country, we have people who come for economic reasons, for political reasons, all sorts of reasons. What we need to do is create a healthy, functional, sane, and safe system to get the great benefit of immigration.
Well, let's give Jeremy and Racine the final word on this. Jeremy, go ahead. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. It's not the first time we deploy National Guard troops. I've had friends be deployed down to the border to do security. I just don't see it being a long-term solution at all. If anything, it's just going to increase tensions between an allied state, which is Mexico. They are allies. When we start deploying our troops down to the borders, that sends a signal to Mexico. And in return, they may send their troops to their border. And it has a great potential of escalating a situation that doesn't really necessarily need that kind of a force amplifier. So the amount of money that's going to be used to deploy all these troops could be redistributed to training more border security, updating infrastructure along the border, things like that. I think that'd be more well spent than deploying our National Guard troops down to an allied state like Mexico. So,
well, Jeremy, thanks so much for the call. You're in the mix on Week in Review. We give two analysts with different political perspectives voices. Kevin Hermaning here, chair of the Republican Party of Marathon County, financial planner from Wausau. John Nichols, associate editor of the Cap Times, national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine. You can join the conversation, 800-642-1234. What do you make of the Mueller probe, that the president is not a criminal target in the probe we learned this week? What do you think of the Sinclair Broadcast Group video and TV stations reading the same message about fake news? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back for more in two shakes here on the Ideas Network. We're in the thick of Week in Review. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. At the table, Kevin Hermaning, chair of the Republican Party of Marathon County. John Nichols, associate editor of the Cap Times. You can join in, 800-642-1234. What about this? Is Scott Pruitt the right leader for the EPA, or is he distracting from the work you want the agency to accomplish? What do you think of the Sinclair video? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Before we move on, let's first make a stop here on China tariffs. Earlier this week, the U.S. announced tariffs on $50 billion worth of Chinese goods. The country responded within hours, announcing $50 billion worth of tariffs on U.S. goods. The president also mentioned that China during a tax reform roundtable yesterday in West Virginia.
For many years, no president wanted to go against China economically, and we're going to do it. We had a trade deficit of almost $500 billion last year with China.
Okay, so and yesterday, Trump also issued another volley saying he was considering whether $100 billion of additional tariffs would be appropriate. Kevin, what's going on here? What is the next step?
So in this area, I think the president is wrong about a belief in tariffs in general, but I think that he is shrewdly going back to his roots of, quote unquote, the art of the deal. This is a negotiating ploy in advance of him going to South Korea next month to meet with Kim Jong-un of North Korea, who is really controlled by China. And the president is going to, in my view, end up asking China for help. And in exchange, China is going to demand the removal of any proposed tariffs. Now, none of these tariffs have gone into place yet. They've all been proposed. The earliest, my understanding is, they would go into place, effect would be in June.
But markets have reacted.
Markets, of course, react because people, because of headlines and economic noise, and I get all that, and it actually provides opportunities for people like me and for our clients. But the truth of the matter is, in my view, this is a negotiating effort. The president is, we know, not exclusively, but all about the headlines. He's all about going back to the roots of his campaign, which had to do with, he was going to protect everybody from coal miners in West Virginia, Ohio, and Pennsylvania to folks who make products that have been threatened by imports. And so he wants to make good on those promises, but he's running up against the reality that national security issues and overall global, not just American, but global economic conditions. Earlier, John talked about globalization, and I certainly remember reading Thomas Friedman's book, The Art of the Earth is Flat. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a fan of Thomas Friedman, but or The World is Flat, I guess, is what I meant to say if I didn't say it already. And he talked about globalization primarily in the early 21st century. And that phrase is a metaphor for viewing the world as a level playing field in terms of commerce. But it also extends to beyond commerce and economics. It extends to diplomacy and public policy and healthcare and all the other things that go on between nations. And so we're going to really find ourselves continuing to have to compete and be better educationally and economically if we want to compete against other people globally who aren't as good as us at innovation, but are certainly as good or better than us at taking our ideas and then making them cheaper for broad consumer bases.
But close to home here on the ground level, these tariffs from China could certainly affect Wisconsin, John. The proposed 15% tariff on ginseng, for example, mm-hmm. Wisconsin grows about 90% of the U.S. crop. Yeah. So this would have an impact on Wisconsin.
Poor Scott Walker's talked more about ginseng than just about anything else over his 8 years as governor. And so every time he goes on a foreign trade mission, he talks about ginseng. And,
As he should.
I'm with you, brother. But, you know, the fact of the matter is now you got a president who's messing with that. Here, I'm embarrassed for my president. Donald Trump is scorchingly unprepared for the activities he's gotten himself involved in here. If he is using a threat of tariffs to get some kind of Chinese cooperation as regards North Korea, then, boy, is he going to have a blowback here at home. I mean, if you think a blue wave might have been coming, if he backs off some of these steel protections because he got some sort of deal over in Korea, I can't even begin to tell you how bad that will be for him politically. But on the second side here, the fact the guy knows nothing about trade policy. You know, here you put tariffs on China, right? And then China comes back, of course, as they would, and you say, well, then we're going to up our tariffs. Does he not understand where the trade deficit came from? The trade deficit is China has a lot more stuff that it's sending here than the U.S. has sending there. The president is already well down the road to frittering away all of his bargaining power on that, and the Chinese will still have immense amounts more. Now, the fact is, tariffs are often good. There are often places where they can be used. Countries throughout history have. But they have to be used in the context of an industrial policy that brings in agriculture, other industries, that recognizes the whole of the picture. The president has, in my opinion, been embarrassingly inept on this. And I'm sort of stunned, actually, that here you have a president doing all this talk and not recognizing, you know, why this thing isn't working and why it won't work.
Well, we need to move on here. Let's turn to Russia. Special Counsel Robert Mueller's team of prosecutors informed President Trump's attorneys this week that the president is not currently considered a criminal target in the Russia investigation. So the Washington Post broke that story Tuesday with unnamed sources. For the president, it reinforces his belief that he is in the clear. Now, critics are saying it might give the president a false sense of security. So, Kevin, what do you make of this latest development in the Mueller probe?
Well, it's something that the president's been saying for a long time. And, of course, he's been denying that he did anything wrong. Of course, he probably would say that anyway, just like any person who is accused of something until the smoking gun shows up. I happen to think that this is more to do about nothing myself. I do believe that. And it's been a colossal waste of time and media attention. And it's actually emboldened the folks who support Donald Trump, because a lot of people who supported President Trump believe that he's not been given the opportunity to govern, irrespective of what John says and about that he's unprepared or he doesn't know all the issues. And frankly, President Obama didn't know jack about importing tires to the United States back in 2011. And, of course, he tried to go toe-to-toe with China and lost. And, of course, that's exactly what's going to happen here anyway with President Trump. So I think that this whole Mueller investigation needs to be shut down. I love the idea. I'm just going to be candid. Love the idea of a second independent counsel to look into FBI and Justice Department collusion with regard to the Clinton campaign, the Clinton Foundation. None of that has been fully vetted yet, in my view. And I think that it's going to be a long, hot summer in Washington, D.C., where you're going to have competing investigations. And it's reminiscent of the late 1990s and the early 1970s. But at the end of the day, I don't think this amounts to a hill of beans, except for the publicity on both sides that has really been used to generate fundraising appeals by political parties and conservative and progressive organizations.
Kevin offering nice scene setting there. Let's go to Rick now in Park Falls. Hi, Rick.
Well, I just wanted to comment on the steadily deteriorating relationships between Russia and the West. And specifically, I heard on NPR News this week that one individual named Sergei Naryshkin, who is the head of the SVR, that's foreign intelligence, made a specific threat directed against the United States. And I don't remember the exact translation, but it went something like this, that for far too long, America has held a position of global dominance, and Russia and her allies are going to do everything possible to topple the United States from this position. And the reason this kind of comment should not be underestimated is because Vladimir Putin has established a regime in Russia based on government-inspired terrorism and political murder. He has murdered every single critic or opposition politician to his reign going back to the year 1998. And a couple of those people have had American citizenship, like Paul Kolebnikov, who was the editor of Forbes Russia, who Putin had murdered, and the muckraking journalist, Anna Politkovskaya, who was born in New York City in 1958 and had American citizenship. He had her bumped off by that.
And Rick, I'm gonna have you pause right there to bring John back into the circle on Russia. John, your thoughts?
Well, I don't know where we started there and where we ended up here.
It was a circuitous path here.
I'll let Rick's statements stand. I think that, you know, we need to have a strong relationship and a solid relationship with Russia. I don't think that I think it's interesting that the people who are very impressed with Donald Trump standing up to China don't seem to be asking him to stand up with quite as much strength to Russia. I find
well, what about the 60 diplomats kicked out last yesterday?
And the 60 kicked out back and forth. And the fact of the matter is Donald Trump has really been silly on this issue. And I hope it's just silly. I hope it's not more dangerous and more troubling than that. The fact of the matter is we began this with the Mueller investigation. I'm not a big fan of special counsels on either side. I think Congress should do its job. We're supposed to have a system of checks and balances. Paul Ryan has been a miserable Speaker of the House, completely ceding his responsibilities. And so you have these special counsels coming in on all sides. As regards people suggesting that the president is not currently the subject of a criminal investigation, all I can tell you is it reminds me of a race for sheriff I once covered in Texas, where one of the candidates said, unlike my opponent, I'm not currently under indictment. That isn't the standard for presidents of the United States. The standard for the president of the United States is not that he's avoiding criminal inquiry at this point. Donald Trump has done a lousy, lousy job of leading as a honorable and functional president, and he has gotten himself into a lot of trouble. That trouble will continue throughout his presidency. People would like to say that it's about partisanship. It extends from the president himself.
And Kevin, any response there before we move on here to our one final topic?
No, let's move on.
All right. Well, let's
Running
tie. You're a very good eye on the clock, sir. Thank you. So the Sinclair Broadcast Group video this week, we have a clip of that montage put together by Deadspin. Let's take a listen.
The sharing of biased and false news has become all too common on social media. More alarming, some media outlets publish these same fake stories without checking facts first.
So, John, weigh in here, journalist hat on. You've got anchors across the country saying the same message about false news.
Sure, I feel for the anchors. I mean, many of these are really honorable people who are put in a bad position. And look, here's the bottom line. We have had local television stations across this country that have express conservative views, that express liberal views, sometimes in editorials, sometimes, you know, slipping into the news. And that's a part of the history of broadcasting in this country. The crisis with Sinclair is its bigness. There's 173 stations, and they're trying to extend it by about
193.
I think it might be
170. Okay.
Let's not debate. We've got
time running out.
We're in the
right
range
here.
Of 200.
Shy of 200. I'm going to stick with 193.
They're trying to get now another 42 to 45 more stations. This is the crisis of bigness and one size fits all. There is nothing healthy about letting one company have that much influence, be it liberal or conservative, Republican, Democrat, whatever. And so what we ought to focus on here is saying no to Sinclair's proposal before the FCC to merge in or to buy up the Tribune stations.
Kevin, last word.
You know, I'm a free trader. I am a free enterprise guy. Those phrases, I need to put the word fair in there. And if fair and independent arbiters determine that we are not finding ourselves in a monopolistic system, I am going to not object to it. But I was interested to learn a couple of weeks ago during the Olympics that there was a TV station in Chicago that mixed up in one of their graphics during the Olympics, Pyeongchang instead of P.F. Chang's. And I wonder if the people who worked there actually knew that that was wrong before it was pointed out and vilified across the world.
Kevin and John, good stuff this week. Thank you so much. Kevin Hermaning, chairman of the Republican Party of Marathon County, financial planner from Wausau. John Nichols, associate editor of the Capital Times, national affairs correspondent of The Nation magazine. This edition of Week in Review was produced by Brianne Chasso and Keely Baltina. Technical direction from Dave Potraz. Michelle Johnson, executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Have a great weekend. We'll meet you back here next week on the Ideas Network.